what's going on now is going to have long-term implications for our ability to reassert our position in the region.
Welcome back to Inside Asia. I'm Steve Stein. In this episode, we're talking about the impending U.S.-China trade war and what it means for both sides. It's a subject we've covered for months, and now it appears our worst fears are coming true. President Trump has followed through with his $250 billion in tariffs impacting over 6,000 China-made products, with more to come, apparently. China has retaliated with its own set of tariffs. You can see where this is headed, and make no mistake, consumers and workers on both sides will bear the brunt of it. To discuss what the impact of an all-out trade war could be, I sat with Wendy Cutler in her Washington, D.C. office. Wendy served under the Obama administration as Deputy U.S. Trade Representative and now holds the title of Vice President and Managing Director for the Asia Society Policy Institute. For her, watching this trade debacle unfold is particularly painful. Wendy spent years developing and negotiating the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement, or TPP. She remains one of the most astute and clear-headed commentators on Asia trade. I started off by asking her to give us a little background about herself, how she arrived at the Asia Society, and something about her current role.
I was at the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative for 28 years as a trade negotiator, largely involved in negotiations with different Asian countries, including Korea, Japan, China, and others. Towards the end of my career, I was a senior negotiator on the TPP negotiations as Ambassador Froman's deputy, and I decided to leave USTR upon the completion of TPP, having felt like I've done everything as a trade negotiator that I wanted to accomplish. And I was very excited to be offered an opportunity to work for the Asia Society Policy Institute, which is really the think tank of the Asia Society and a relatively new think tank, having been in existence for about 4 years.
Does this free you up to comment and do more around trade, or are you now diversifying into other areas?
Well, it's interesting. When I took this job, I wanted to diversify into other areas. But what I found that trade under President Trump has become such a hot topic that it's very hard to leave this space. And people are turning to me, both former colleagues and media and other folks, trying to understand what's going on, particularly given my expertise as a practitioner.
As a policy wonk, best of times and worst of times.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So diversifying has not been easy. I'm kind of more focused on trade than I'd initially hoped to be, but we're really in uncharted waters. So I find this time extremely interesting. And I think it's important that people really understand what's going on, what are the implications, and where our trading partners fit into all of this.
Well, understanding, I think, is what we're all trying to do, because it does seem to be running at odds with great economic trade thinking and policy. It seems that there's a bit of a rogue mentality about what can and should be done in this point of time, particularly with China.
Yeah, exactly. And part of the overall mission of the Asia Society is to really promote understanding between the United States and Asia. And so through my work at the Asia Society Policy Institute, I try and look at trade issues in conjunction with former colleagues. And one of our missions is to kind of come up with papers that have joint recommendations, not just U.S. recommendations, but U.S./Asian recommendations about what we can do in the trade world. How can we further integrate the trading system? How can we help the trading system become more relevant? And how can we make trade more inclusive?
You know, in many ways, Trump makes trade sound so simple. It's doing a deal. It's sitting down, having a conversation, walking away. But you know better. Trade is a very laborious, complicated thing. I'd like for you to help us understand what it entails, maybe by talking about the work you did around TPP.
Mm-hmm. Well, sure. And I totally agree with your premise. Trade negotiations are some of the most difficult negotiations to undertake because you're really feeling it from all sides. You have domestic pressures from your companies, from your workers, from your legislatures, but then you also have to work with your trading partners. You don't have a deal unless they agree to the deal. And so a lot of times in my career, I found myself at points where I felt that everyone was unhappy with the work I was doing. Because everyone wanted more, people thought we were being unfair. It's just a very difficult and complicated profession. But I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I felt that compromises and agreements could be reached, but patience was probably one of the main attributes that was most important, because these negotiations don't happen overnight. They're not quick by nature. They're very detailed. They involve a lot of trade-offs. And frankly, they involve a lot of domestic politics, not only for the United States, but for our trading partners. And TPP was, you know, an example of everything I just said. It was a very ambitious negotiation involving 11 other trading partners in Asia, in Latin America, in North America, coming together with the same objective, wanting to achieve high standard rules and wanting to achieve better market access. But that's at a very, very high level. It's when you get into the details, that's when the difficulties emerge, and particularly when you negotiate with 11 countries with different levels of development.
So for instance, what were some of those early stage sticking points and which governments were most reluctant, just to give us a sense of what it took to get everyone to the table?
Yeah. So, you know, every country has its own, what we call in the trade world, sensitivities. Those are sectors that have been largely protected, where they're very reluctant to open, either in fear of competition or just not wanting to adopt the rules that other countries say they should follow. So for Japan, for example, the agriculture sector was probably the most difficult sector to negotiate with Japan, largely protected sector. They knew they needed to open this market in TPP at a very high level. That was, you know, they agreed to that when they joined TPP. But when you sit down and you go product by product, what does opening really mean? Is it reducing a tariff in 5 years, or is it reducing a tariff in 15 years? And is it eliminating the tariff, or is it putting in a quota? So these are very detailed negotiations. For a country like Vietnam, it was very concerned about some of the rules that we and others were asking Vietnam to adopt, particularly in the areas of labor, particularly in the area of labor. And so ultimately, they agreed to the labor provisions of TPP, but it was a hard slog for them, and we had to we had a lot of back and forth, and we spent a lot of time in the capital in Vietnam, not just convincing the trade negotiators, but helping them convince their political apparatus that this was the right thing to do, that this would help them over time and really help them in their desire to move up the value chain, to attract foreign direct investment, to grow their economy, and to create jobs.
So even going so far as to working to craft arguments that they could use in order to get the political backing that they needed?
Yeah, I mean, I've been in negotiations where a counterpart has said, look, I want to do this. I think it's the right thing. But can you help me? Can you put yourself in my shoes and help, you know, give me the points where I can explain to my domestic constituency why this is my country's interest? And when a country asks you that, you kind of feel like we're headed towards a solution here. We're having a good conversation. A lot of times in negotiations, people are very focused on what they want. But it's not enough to know what you want. You need to be able to figure out how I'm going to bring this deal together. And so sometimes by listening very carefully to your counterpart, you can better understand their reluctance to accept your proposal. And sometimes if you listen carefully, the reasons why they don't like your proposal are often very different than the reasons you initially think that they will object to the proposal. And so at times I have found that the characteristic of listening carefully is extremely important in a negotiation. In addition, it's very important to develop trust with your counterparts. You need to be in a position to be able to explore things with them and know that they're not going to run to the press and say, well, you said this and you said that. Trust is very important in terms of trying to make a deal. Look, at the end of the day, we're all there to get as much as we can for our country. That's clear. But once again, it takes two to tango, or it takes a group to tango with you. You don't have a deal if you keep insisting on this is what I want, this is what I need. And I've been in negotiations where things have fallen apart because I just didn't have the flexibility from above to do the things that would have required a deal to be made. And frankly, sometimes maybe it's not time for the type of deal we were seeking, and that's okay as well. But it's kind of having that sense of when things are headed in the right direction versus when there is a serious roadblock and we really need to reconsider, is this really what we want to do? Because if we want it, this is what we're going to have to give in return.
Well, it's this word trust. And I'd like to touch on that a little more because it's not necessarily just about the tariffs or the limits or the hurdles or the finances. It's really about, you know, can I look somebody in the eye and in good faith say, we're trying to arrive at a compromise which is meaningful for us. What has been done under this administration that could severely damage or lengthen the ability of us to kind of resolve this in time around that trust issue?
Right. And so one of the key things is you need to stand by your word. And so when I look at the China negotiations, Secretary Mnuchin went to China, reached a deal, came home, we announced it, said that tariffs were on hold. And then less than a week later, the president reversed that decision. And it's interesting. It wasn't just an issue that affects trust with China, because when the announcement was made just last month about a new way forward with the European Union, the question was asked to the European Union, are you sure that this deal is going to stick? And after what happened with China, I think a lot of our trading partners are wondering, even if we make this deal with this administration, is it going to hold? Is it going to stick? And if it's not, then do I want to take the domestic risks that the deal would entail and do the domestic work I need to, only to find out that this thing is not worth the paper it's written on?
Is this then creating a wait and see mentality? Rather than do anything, let's do nothing for now and then go on and carve out trade deals with other trading partners and see where the U.S. ends up a couple years from now?
I don't think it's wait and see yet with the United States, but I do think that people are a bit wary negotiating with us. But for sure, all of our trading partners are looking elsewhere to find partners on trade. And you can just look at the number of negotiations that have been announced or been accelerated or been concluded in the past year and a half to get a sense that our trading partners are looking to diversify so they're not so dependent on the United States and so that they would have more leverage in any trade negotiation with the United States. To be clear, our trading partners were diversifying before Trump. I mean, it wasn't everyone was just negotiating with the United States, but we've seen a real acceleration of this trend, and that worries me. And it worries me in that when the United States is ready to get back in the game, I think the trade landscape in Asia is going to look very different, and we're going to have to earn our way back.
This is Inside Asia, and my guest is Wendy Cutler, former Deputy U.S. Trade Representative during the Obama administration and now Vice President and Managing Director of the Asia Society Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. During the second part of our conversation, I asked Wendy to imagine a full-scale trade war. If all the threatened tariffs were put into place, what would happen? Who would come out on top and who would blink first?
My view is both sides are losing already, and they're going to lose more. So you can read stories about companies in the United States that are laying off people already, mainly due to the steel and aluminum tariffs, but some due to the retaliatory tariffs from China, like Harley-Davidson, which has announced it's going to move some of its production overseas. Workers are being laid off, and consumers are going to be paying more. And that's
workers are being laid off in anticipation of the impact or because it's all already settling?
There are stories now. I mean, it's more anecdotal, but there are stories of companies that are actually laying off people. And this is largely due to the increase in prices of steel due to our steel and aluminum trade action. So the price of steel has gone up about 33%. You know, that's a key input into many, many products. Many more companies use steel versus produce steel. And so I think with time, as we retaliate more against China in particular, and China responds, we're going to see more and more of these stories. And frankly, the same in China. China relies on its exports to the United States. Its economy is beginning to feel the repercussions of these tariffs. And I'm sure there are stories in China as well, where due to U.S. tariffs, some of their industries are either cutting back production or laying off workers. In terms of who can outlast, who is more endurance in this fight? Again, both lose. But if I had to put my money, I think China, in fact, can outlast the United States. And that's not necessarily because the economic hurt would be less. I think it's more due to the nature of their political system, of an authoritarian government, so they can rally their masses, they can control the press. I think they can much more quickly get money to those people who are feeling the hurt versus the United States, where it just takes longer, and typically we have to go through Congress to be able to get funds appropriated to help people who are being hurt by trade actions. And so, I put my money on China. But that said, I think a point's going to come when both sides will come to the conclusion for their own domestic reasons that they need to get back to the negotiating table.
You know, I look for indications in China of what they're prepared to put up with. And I think to the deployment of the anti-missile system that they placed in South Korea, really targeting North Korea, but China reacted strongly to it. And because the Koreans allowed it, there were protests across the country against any Korean-held assets, and Lotte Group, which is one of the big retailers like Carrefour or Walmart, people stopped shopping. As a result, they shut down 10 plus retail outlets and they had ultimately pulled out. This shows what can be done if nationalism is that you blow the flames of nationalism, and also this idea of focusing attention on domestic consumption to make up for exports. Those feel real to me, but what do you think?
No, I think they are real. But at the same time, China needs foreign direct investment. And I'm sure that China's probably trying to figure out how far, should we contemplate going and making it difficult, for example, for U.S. firms to operate in China, or, to make it more difficult to export to China. They need foreign direct investment. They need to continue to see their economy grow for their own domestic reasons. And so these are tough decisions for them as well. And so it will be very interesting to see how this plays out. And that's why my prediction is that there will be a point where both sides, for their own reasons, will come to the table. I think right now, each side is just waiting for the other one to blink first.
And there's no telling how long that will take. It is truly brinkmanship, isn't it, in every regard? There's just thinking about how this might play out. At some point, politically in the U.S., it's shocking to many of us that the Republican leadership is allowing this president to basically drive this agenda when most of them are hardcore free traders.
Exactly. I mean, it's a different world. And when I think, of my career, when we were closely with Congress and we really relied on the Republican Party as the free trade party to help push through any legislation to approve a trade agreement or to get to secure trade promotion authority, the authority that would allow us to negotiate trade agreements. So it's amazing in such a short time, the Republican Party has really become the party that's anti-free trade. And when you look at the latest poll from the Pew Research Foundation, that's exactly what they found, is that the Democrats overall are more free trade than Republicans. And for me, I'm just scratching my head because things are really changing, and they're changing quickly, because that's a very different world than the world I operated in through most of my career, working for both Republican administrations and with Democrat administrations.
Yeah. There's at some point, you do wonder whether or not, politics will come to the fore. And as you point out, pragmatism will rule the day. But it's hard to know what that point is. Do you think that this tipping point will come before the midterms or after?
And that's a great question. I think before, because I think a point will come, and you're already seeing stories of certain Republican candidates for the Senate or for the House going to the White House and saying, things are really difficult for me. This plant is closing. This tariff is affecting my district. And so I think that in the lead up to the election, particularly if retaliation from other countries is more and more targeted against some of these districts, I think the pressure will be put on the administration to somehow de-escalate the situation. And I don't know if that means lifting all of the tariffs right away, but maybe at a minimum, restarting negotiations with China.
Wendy, if you were handed the keys to the car to get this engine back on track, what would be the top three things you would do tomorrow to reestablish, you know, some rationale in how we do this?
With respect to China, I think a negotiated settlement is possible. But I think both sides need to be realistic about what can be achieved, and they need to really understand the other side's genuine constraints. And so, for example, I think calls by the administration for China to eliminate its industrial policy or dismantle its Made in China 2025 policy is just, it's just unrealistic. I think a better way to approach the issue would be, okay, you keep your policies, you keep your program, but let's agree to shape them in a way that don't hurt the United States and other trading partners. So, for example, let's ensure that those programs are non-discriminatory. Let's ensure that they're transparent. Let's ensure that they don't result in global overcapacity. Let's ensure that they don't result in other trade distorting measures. That's the kind of conversation that I would encourage for the U.S. and China to have now. And that requires both sides, you know, moving off of their hardline positions.
You know, in earlier episodes, we did some work on robotics, and China is a major investor in robotics. 70% of the world's investment in robotics is occurring in China today. They have the political will and don't care so much about the displacement. They're going to figure that out later. But they know in order for them to keep that engine moving, they have to be able to have a more competitive position. Robotics is an investment now in order to give them a higher rate of return later. There are political issues in the United States which make it very difficult for U.S. to parallel that, you know, do that in pace. Why would China or how could we reasonably request them to back off the upgrading of their manufacturing base?
Once again, upgrading their manufacturing base is okay. All countries want to move up the value chain. It's just how you do it. And as you do it, are you harming other trading partners? So once again, I think those kind of rules could be negotiated. And I think that, a China conceivably would be open to negotiating those kind of rules, as long as they weren't being told, no, you can't move up the value chain, you can't, you know, get into robotics. But you also raise another really, good question as well, and that is, and this is something I've given a lot of thought to, that trade agreements, they can't correct every issue or every problem. A lot of domestic policies are needed in order for the United States to remain competitive and to ensure that we have the educated workforce to produce the types of products and services that are going to be the ones on the forefront for the next generation. So whether it be more R&D spending, whether it be a better education system, whether it be just, you know, more adjustment for workers who are displaced by technology or by trade, all of those type of programs really would need to go hand in hand with any trade agreement. And when people look to trade agreements and they say they're awful, they're the worst things ever, they don't even know, a lot of times people don't even know what's in these deals, but they're so easy to blame for a lot of the economic woes that countries have. And so people need to be more realistic about what can be achieved in a trade agreement and view it as one tool, which needs to be accompanied by smart and effective domestic policies.
Well, that's an excellent point. It's almost in some ways like a stopgap, buying time in order to get some of the other industrial policies in place and moving forward. Well, you mentioned in a New York Times opinion piece in June, in many ways, if we don't get this right, it also puts us at a disadvantage when it comes to negotiating trade agreements around future technologies, artificial intelligence, data transfer related, e-commerce, things of this sort. Can you just flesh that out a little more for us? What do you mean? In what way?
Yeah. So exactly, if we're not part of these trade negotiations, We're not at the table when the new rules are being written. One of the great things about TPP, when it was being negotiated, and this is now, you know, about 8 years ago, that a lot of the rules, for example, in digital trade were on the forefront of being discussed and with rules actually being written. And we were able to drive a lot of that process because we were at the table, we could put our proposals on the table, and we could work with other countries to convince them that this was the way to go, and this is how a regulatory environment, for example, should be shaped to allow this technology to flourish. Now, not only are we, you know, losing out from, you know, not getting the same market access that other countries are getting, but we're losing our seat at the table. We're not there when countries are asking, oh, what should the next generation of a digital trade agreement look like? What type of rules should we have on artificial intelligence? We need to be in those discussions. We need to help shape those rules. And I worry that as more and more countries, you know, come up with their own blocks and their own trade agreements, and they get more comfortable without the United States at the table, they're just going to go ahead. And maybe in certain instances, they will do the right thing. But having seen firsthand what a lot of countries will do if left alone, a lot of times the rules that they put into place could really work against U.S. interests.
So losing our positioning, losing our place, which we've held, you know, because being the largest market in the world, is dissipating, and that, in some ways, at a high level, is your greatest concern.
Exactly. It's not only that we're not leading now; we're also, you know, we're not fully engaged, and you know, there are losses, and over time, I just think it's going to be hard to get this all back if indeed, under a different administration, for example, if leadership then becomes something we want to achieve. Once again, I think we're going to have to earn our way back. And I think people are going to be a little wary to deal with us. On one hand, they really want us back in the region. But I'm sure part of the thinking of our trading partners will be, well, I can work with this administration, but what happens in 4 years again if indeed we're faced with another administration which wants to, you know, withdraw from all of these trade agreements or rip them up? So I think what's going on now is going to have long-term implications for our ability to reassert our position in the region.
This is Inside Asia, and you've been listening to my conversation with Wendy Cutler, former Deputy U.S. Trade Representative under the Obama administration and now Vice President and Managing Director of the Asia Society Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. This brings us to the Asia Insider Minute, that point of the program where I offer up my take on the conversation we've just heard. Trade accords are complex matters. There's more at stake here than trade imbalance and plus and minus columns. There's politics to consider, protectionism, currency adjustments, and adherence to literally dozens of ongoing bilateral and multilateral trade agreements. It's like three-dimensional chess, and the players are all your trading partners. The Trump administration would have us think differently. There are good deals and bad deals, he tells us, and any deal that doesn't favor the U.S. is bad and therefore unfair. It's a fundamental misunderstanding of what makes trade work in the first place. Compromise is the name of the game, and for experienced negotiators like Wendy Cutler, it's a matter of listening and discerning the minutiae of what's doable, not just for the U.S., but for each of America's trading partners. It takes years of work and scores of talks to reach agreement. China has its own unique set of trade issues. Pressuring China to make changes is one thing, but refusing to negotiate is another. There are many reasons why applying tariffs then walking away is a bad idea, but here's the biggest one. China, and the rest of the world for that matter, have other options. The more belligerent this U.S. president becomes, the more likely the world's other trading partners will focus efforts on doing deals elsewhere. And so they have. Already, the other 11 members of the TPP have moved ahead without the U.S. The EU is negotiating a new deal with Japan, South Korea is discussing its first free trade deal with Russia, and the list goes on and on. The great irony of Trump's trade tactic is that ultimately it affects U.S. workers. If large U.S. segments like automotive, agriculture, textiles, and steel can't remain competitive, it only goes to reason that companies dependent on global markets will have no choice but to downsize their workforce. Consumers are set to suffer as well. Trump's tariffs on Chinese goods alone are expected to translate to nearly $20 billion in higher prices for everything from home appliances to cars to food. One group, the American Action Foundation, a right-of-center Washington, D.C. think tank, says, and I quote, 70% of the proposed tariffs are on goods that U.S. businesses use in domestic production, and over 98% affect the manufacturing industry. So scream America first all you want, President Trump. Your protests land on deaf ears. Your guests are dining elsewhere tonight. Until next week, this is Steve Stein saying, coming from the outside on Inside Asia.